this is Melissa. This is Real History, and today is the 1st of August, 2024. I was scheduled to be doing a talk with John Euler on the transgender agenda, but John is dealing with some issues, and we're stepping away from the series for now. Just to think of what I might put up, I like to stay in the routine, and it's already Thursday night, so I'm a little off the routine, but I had psychopathy on my mind since I had just done those two, and I just looked around to see what is out there that's interesting that I can bring you. I hadn't checked in with JP and Julie from Book of Hours podcast in a while. They've been busy. They had a move in the last year. I've been busy. And I came on something Julie is doing, not every week, but fairly regularly. She's doing something called the Friday Reading and Broadcast. And the latest one that she did last Friday was entitled Predators and Cyberbullies. And I thought, well, thematically, that fits in a bit with the psychopathy. I watched it, and I'll just say that it's very difficult because Julie talks about a cyberbullying incident that she experienced some years back and something that happened to a member of her extended family recently. And I contacted Julie, and I just caught up, you know, kind of got the broad strokes of our lives over the last while. And I asked if they had done anything new in the long-form video category. And she said they'd just been too busy to do anything since the last long-form video that they did last year called Sadism, which we covered in our last Real History. And I linked to it, and I'll link to that again. It was a good video. So it all kind of ties together, bullying, cyberbullying, psychopathy, sadism. I asked her if it would be okay if I used some of her video and incorporated it into something, and she said, of course. So that is what, I will talk a bit about my own thoughts, and then I'm going to take a portion of her talk, and I will, of course, link to her entire episode. But the story that she told about her extended family member, it was very sad. It's a tragedy of cyberbullying, just about the worst kind of tragedy that you can imagine. One girl to another. And I believe in this case the extended family member was probably 14 at the time that this happened. It may have started before then, but that was about the year that it peaked. And I just let this tick around in my head yesterday and last night, and I thought about what makes girls different when they bully? What is bullying? Cyberbullying is just one category of bullying. And we hear that word a lot. They were bullied. They were cyberbullied. But what does it really mean to be bullied? And I go back to my old school days from way back yonder. And I just think, you know, I remember one time I was dragged around the playground by my hair by a boy, and it hurt, and it was bullying. He was picking on me, and I said something to the teacher, and I think the teacher's response was something like, well, he likes you, but he doesn't know how to express that. And it's like, well, tell that to my head. But it just was a different world then. There was no such thing as cyberbullying, and every school, every teacher, every family had a different way of dealing with things that did happen. Boys, I saw, beat up other boys, and girls did really mean things to each other. And I thought I would just stick with girls for this little talk. So I watched a little bit of, I remember a movie that came out, really, I was well into adulthood, so it wasn't my thing, but it was called Mean Girls. And I looked that up, saw some clips, got the tone of that. It was rather comedic in tone. And I noticed that they're making a musical about Mean Girls. So, and 20 years later, after the original movie came out. But a movie that was a little closer, just a little bit closer in age to my time, was a movie called Heathers. And so I went back and I watched a little bit of that. And the interesting thing, I actually watched it with the volume down. I don't know why. I just did. And one of the first scenes that I came to was the group of Heathers. The Heathers. They were all Heather. And some of the girls who were not nice were writing a mock love letter. You could get all of this without the sound. You could see the group of, you know, popular, attractive boys. The girls had concocted this idea that they were going to write a letter to the very heavy, the overweight, the fat girl, the one that gets picked on, the one that gets bullied because she's different. And they did. They slipped this love letter, and then you could see where it was going. And, you know, truthfully, I never saw Heathers. I knew what it was about, but I didn't watch it at the time. Because that, too, was just a little bit below where I was in my, you know, I was already into adulthood. So still thinking, what is it that makes it different between girls that there's just something so cruel? It's not just punch somebody in the face because you're taller than them or more muscular. It's just there's a kind of cruelty there at a certain stage in many girls' development, not all. So I started listening to different experts. I did that today while I was doing a few other things. I just had the television on to YouTube and turned it up loud and let myself do a little bit of chores while I listened to the experts talk. And one of the things that struck me is that there's, at least from my glance, and I should probably back up and say I have no training in any kind of psychology or therapy, or, you know, this is not my field. And what I'm talking about here, these are my thoughts, my musings, and that's all. But what struck me was that there seemed to be a lack of consensus about what it is and how to deal with it. I kept wanting to make a connection. Is there a higher incidence of psychopathy amongst people who bully? And you can find statistics. What does that mean? And the one statistic that I found a couple of times, there's at least that much agreement that the incidence of psychopathy in the male prison population is roughly 30%. And the incidence of female psychopathy in their prison population is approximately 17%. But what is it in the real world? And of course, that is harder to find. There are people who believe that psychopaths are born that way, that you're seeing differences in brain scans. And then, of course, we've just covered in the series the idea that there is a descent into deviancy that correlates with psychopathic behavior. But consensus is not really to be found. In the brain scan category, I had an interesting back and forth with a friend of mine in Allen's whose educational training was biochemistry. And he always has interesting things that he's looking into. And of course, he studies everything quite deeply. And about 6 weeks ago, we'd had a very long conversation about psychopathy and deviancy and the brain. And I think it'll be okay if I share a little bit of one of his emails. He was talking about deviancy, transsexuals, etc., deviancy, and he said, "These deviant persons have permanently altered key portions of their brain structure by thickening the gray matter in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, and the consequent abnormal patterns of activity are implicit in psychiatric disorders such as major depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, schizophrenia, psychopathy, and autism. This happens by ignoring and abolishing the natural pre-wired propensity of disgust that allows them to involve themselves in their disgusting and abhorrent lifestyle activities. This happens by ignoring and abolishing the natural pre-wired propensity of disgust that allows them to involve themselves in their disgusting and abhorrent lifestyle activities and sexual behavior, attaching that emotion to, quote, love or, quote, lust deformations. The VMPFC, that's the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, is located in the frontal lobe at the bottom of the cerebral hemispheres and is implicated in the processing of risk and fear, as it is critical in the regulation of amygdala activity in humans, also playing a role in the inhibition of emotional responses and in the process of decision-making and self-control, also involved in the cognitive evaluation of morality. Thus, in consequence, physically changing their brains permanently and dangerously with the changes seen in those serious psychiatric conditions." So he's saying that there is a cry for tolerance and acceptance in that group because we, those who are not involved in these behaviors, have caused that to happen in their brains because of our disgust at them. And he gave me a couple of links to studies, and I'll post those. But he said, their activities themselves are the reason, and there is nothing we can do to reverse it, ever. This is why pushing it so hard into children's minds begins causing the same type of damage when unchallenged by discussion or outburst of that natural disgust. In other words, you can't allow people to be disgusted by it because we've normalized it societally. And he goes on to conclude his email, "This physical damage appears permanent." So I think that it's that we won't have consensus on, you know, in this case, he's talking about sexually deviant persons. We weren't specifically talking about psychopathy. But we are talking about an ability, if ability may not be a good word, but the risk of actually changing the structure of your brain because of the activities that you get involved in. I had a bit of a discussion about, are we born, you know, the nature of evil. Are we born good or not good? And I had used to illustrate that the Confucian philosophers, and I had said that Alan would come down on this side of Xunzi, who said that we were born bad. And I got an email back from someone that I think that confused them, and maybe it's time to do a longer series and draw a little bit from excerpts of Alan's talks where he gets into psychopathy in greater detail. The confusion from the listener was that Alan said, well, humans just have lacked good models that we have to learn how to be human. That thought, the idea that yes, we do need better models for becoming fully human and wholesome, whole, integrated, doesn't override the idea that we can be born with, you know, not good or a propensity to not good. So Mengzi was the Confucian philosopher who believed that we are innately good-natured. And Xunzi said, no, we are not. We are evil. Xunzi's diagnosis of human nature and education and ideals and discovering the way and what is wrong with society. And remember, this is a long, long time ago. He diagnosed the main cause of disorder as a breakdown of the social hierarchy. When hierarchical distinctions are confused and people do not follow their proper roles, they compete indiscriminately to satisfy their desires. The way to put limits on this competition is to clarify social distinctions, such as you would have between an older sibling and a younger sibling, between men and women, so everyone knows what their social obligations are. And in that way, they can find the context for developing what is good in them. His concern was with moral education. He wanted people to develop into good people, not just people who knew a lot, but were good. And there's one quote from him. It's a pretty simple one that can be memorized. He said, human nature is evil. Any good in humans is acquired by conscious exertion. Meaning at a young age, people had to be helping the young child know what they were striving towards. It's not just the social norms or the proscribed behavior between man and woman, siblings, authority figures, and so forth. It is to inculcate in them the knowledge of what is good, and then showing them that that must be achieved by effort. It takes effort. So that's just a little bit of a background there. It's just a little bit of something to think about there, because when I think about mean girls or girls who are bullies, I have to go down the path of what is good and how is good arrived at and how do we train ourselves to go in that direction instead of what might come more naturally. A common definition of a bully is someone with more power. They're bigger or they have more power or more social status, who preys upon people weaker for their own satisfaction. And generally, someone engaging in bullying behavior, there's no empathy there. You can't point out to them that their behavior is hurting someone because they don't care, and in fact, that may be the object. So just pointing out their bad behavior won't change them. In listening to the experts and not seeing a consensus, but I did learn some interesting things from these experts. Suicide is on the rise. Suicide, particularly among young girls, is on the rise. There are lots of reasons given for this, but there is a correlation between cyberbullying and attempted suicide. Whether it's successful or not, there's a definite observed correlation. And one of the things that Julie of Book of Hours mused about, what she said, I don't vote. I'm not a voter, that's not looking for a solution there, but if I did, this would become an issue for me, addressing cyberbullying. And I looked at what schools have in place and how they deal with that in-house, and there seems to be a lot of awareness in the school system going back for probably at least a decade and a half, where this has become an increasingly big issue that is dealt with. And yet, papers that I looked at show that the programs of awareness that are in place at schools don't actually help the problem, and in fact, may exacerbate it. One reason I was looking for why that would be, and I listened to a TED talk. I don't listen to many of those, but there was a man who was talking about adult bullying. And his solution for adults, this is different, but what he said is you have to learn how to deal with it. You've got to become strong yourself, because the bully is never going to back down. Whatever's in place there, they just go underground with their bullying. They go on the quiet with it. Then you start getting more into things like gaslighting. Oh no, I'm not bullying them. One of the experts that I listened to was making a lot of sense, and I just wanted to find out a little bit more about her and what her approach was. And as I was reading her bio, she advertised herself as competent, I guess, you know, in her relationship work, competent or trained to work with kink and polyamory. And I thought, okay, well, I know what polyamory is, but what is kink, you know, in the world of, I don't know, psychology, what is it? So, well, I mean, it is exactly what it sounds like. And this is very interesting, because the first thing that I thought of then is when you enter into the world of, I'll just say, alternative sexual relationships, what might come with that is an inbuilt predatory component. You just think about the popularization of books and shows and podcasts and so forth, where the cocky young man is telling other young men how to score, how, you know, how to grow your list of conquests. So there's a predatory nature there that is, seems to me to be inbuilt there. And I've heard, you know, there was one psychologist that I investigated this afternoon who said that she was a lesbian and had earlier in her life been involved in the kink and polyamorous world. And she did not think that inbuilt into that was any kind of moral, well, anyway, it wasn't a bad thing, right? But the other expert, the psychologist that I was looking at, was a much more traditional woman in a marriage to a man with children, talking about how she dealt with bullying with her own children. But here she is helping people not to come out of kink and polyamory, but helping them navigate that. So I thought, well, let's just take a look and see if I'm right, if my gut, that there is a high amount of predation that goes on in that world. And sure enough, they've got terms like you're a cowgirl or a cowboy if you want to rope someone in a monogamous relationship out of that monogamous relationship for your own pleasure. That is predatory behavior. So what I'm saying is, I'm not sure that we can look to the experts to help us with some of our modern dilemmas. I'm not sure that we can legislate our way out of it either. What then would be helpful? And again, I thought of Alan, especially in 2020, in the longer talks that he did, he talked quite a few times about psychopathy and the nature of evil and what is it that we're actually looking at when we see a psychopath, and how important it is to understand the signs and symptoms of a psychopath. And I think that there is something there, that if we know, we don't need to get too caught up in the psychological definitions. We don't need to know terms like dark triad, and we don't need to know too much about how psychologists think of this, because again, they're experts, they're humans, and in their own way, they've been molded and shaped by the environment that they're coming up in. Their own moral compass could simply be a little bit out of whack, because this is the culture that we live in. When I encountered that one, the talk from this one psychologist, and then looked at a couple of articles around kink and polyamory, I found something that didn't surprise me in the least, was that the rise of kink and polyamorous behavior and relationships rose quite dramatically during and after the pandemic. Now, the excuse I saw, and I'm not sure I can access all of these articles again. I looked at a lot of things. I closed some windows, but I'll try to supply as much documentation as I can. We know that pornography use rose during that time. So the excuse that was given in one article that I saw in Psychology Today magazine was that people reevaluated their lives during the pandemic, and they decided that they wanted to live perhaps more adventurously. Okay, so that's one way of looking at it. But other statistics that we saw were isolation and loneliness amongst the teenage or the youth population, suicide or suicidal ideation amongst that youth population on the increase during the pandemic. And again, personally, I'm not an expert, but my own idea about this is that the young people looked around and saw how ill-equipped the adults were to cope with that situation in a healthy and assertive and non-victim stance. And so there was no modeling there for the children. That has to be a very depressing thing too. But back to girls. The bullying that girls do is described as relational bullying. So again, we see the boys will, you know, engage in a lot of really vicious, bad behavior, but it tends to be more just brute. I'm going to beat you up. I'm going to bash your head in. But the girls, it's relational bullying. Listening to all of this brought me back to my own childhood and bullying that I experienced and participated in. And one of the first bullying stories that comes into my mind was the story, well, I should say, in my childhood, my two best friends were girls, and I'm going to call them Jane and Julie. And there were three of us, always, for a period of several years. It was not two of us being best friends, but it was three. So already there's the triangle and there's the triangulation. It was very seldom three of us happy, three of us in sync. It was typically two against one. This was the dynamic. So the first story I remember, I am not sure how old I was, but I believe that I was about 11 or 12, and we went to the university swimming pool. That there was a public swim there, and there were a few of us, boys and girls, and I believe that it was supervised. That would be, you know, as permissive and lax as it was when I was a child, I still think there was some supervision there. But for whatever reason, the three of us down in this kind of dark, you know, it was poorly lit, old basement changing room bathroom of the pool complex, I just had the sense, which turned out to be correct, that we were the last ones there, or near the last. And the two decided that they were going to abandon me in that dark bathroom. And we were changing, and at the point that they did their escape, I only had a towel around me. And what they did, they had figured out the master lights. They went upstairs. I was in a stall, had the towel on, and they turned the lights out. And I was terrified. And I was scared, and I called out, and no one answered. And so I ran up the stairs with this towel around me. At this point, they had found, you know, like the two or three remaining boys from the opposite side of the pool complex. And they were laughing and pointing at me and saying, "Oh, she came up with only a towel on. You're naked. You're naked." You know, I mean, I did have a towel on. But in other words, they were trying to further the bullying by shaming me because I didn't get dressed and I was afraid of the dark. But I didn't care. Because my fear of being abandoned and being in the dark overrode any kind of social concern about what they thought of me or mocking me. But that was the first incident. And I participated in this as well. So in other words, it would be me and Jane or me and Julie against, you know, the third member of the triangle. And ways in which we did this over this period of time that we were all best friends, you know, might be gossiping, you know, talking badly about the others, or even spreading rumors amongst our classmates about some of them. So this is a definite, I'm describing definite textbook bullying that I participated in, relational bullying with my friends. Now, as it turns out, they both still live in the area, and they've got children, and they're lovely ladies, and and we're all so busy with our lives that we don't see each other very often. But neither one of these women turned out to be a psychopath, and I do know that if I needed help from one of them, even though we don't have, you know, it's certainly not talking weekly or anything like that, I just know I could call on either one of them and they would help me. So whatever bad behavior that we were involved in at that time, we outgrew it. I'm sure that we had some, you know, constructive education at home and in the system, but I would go to my mother during that time and I would say, "Jane and Julie said, and they, you know, they did, and blah, 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 blah." And my mother had some, you know, practical things that she would say, and not nearly the kind of awareness that parents have nowadays about this, but my mother would say, "Why do you care what other people think about you?" And I never forgot that, because that is actually a good way to cope with being bullied, with being laughed at and mocked, is why do you care? But of course, that's easier said than done, because children and youth are very prone to cave at disapproval. And this stays with us throughout our life. It's something that we all have to be aware of and work on, to be whole within ourselves and not dependent on the approval of other people, because that's so easily and quickly withdrawn at a whim. I also thought about, you know, Lord of the Flies, the book, the movie, William Golding's book. Because in this, you have a group of young boys who are stranded on an island, and they're schoolboys, they're well-behaved, they're well-trained, but there's a breakdown, as there's no adult input there is a complete breakdown and a return to savagery. So this whole story is the idea of where do the morals come from and can that be lost? And I think that there is something there that we hopefully are guided by appropriate modeling into what it is to be a good person, a moral, upright person. And that we hold those lessons dear to us and are always in our adult life in a place of self-examination, self-critique. And, you know, did I do that? I know that Jane or Julie or myself, if we ever as adults engaged in the kind of behavior that we did with each other when we were 12 and 13, that we would be horrified. I mean, I don't see us doing that. But we live in a time where there's increasing moral relativity and it is harder for people. We make more exceptions and we normalize more types of behavior. And children sometimes need black and white, right and wrong. I am going to use a little bit of footage from a movie that Alan and I liked from the 50s called The Bad Seed. And I remember when we watched that, Alan said, that is a really good depiction of a young girl who is a psychopath. I'm simply saying, you know, like I said, I'm not qualified to come down with, you know, advice or anything like that about this issue. And it's very difficult, especially when a situation like this harms you or harms a young child. And there are some cases where you look, if we knew everything about the story, we might learn that the parents had done everything right, that they had been the best kind of example, that they had provided the best and most loving and nurturing environment for their children. And still, the children fall victim to these kind of predators. And so that, I think that is the point of what I'm saying, is that it's very worthwhile to always be reminding ourselves what is psychopathic, what is bullying, what is narcissistic, what are these behaviors that we want to stay away from? Because this is very real. I mean, Julie talks about the incident that happened to her over a span of time in her adulthood and how much it hurt her and confused her. And I have to say that since Alan has passed, I have had a lot of bullying. I will call it cyberbullying. And I don't want to go into the details because, frankly, I don't want to give anybody ideas. But this started almost probably within a week of his passing. And the first example of it, I will just say that it was someone who wanted me to know that they knew where I lived and that they knew that I was alone. And I have had all kinds of bullying in the cyber world since then. And like I said, I don't need to discuss it publicly. I don't need anybody to have any ideas, but it is hurtful and sometimes it's frightening. It is a kind of a vampiric behavior too, because it eats up, you know, my time and emotions and attention and, you know, where I'm combating or defending or, you know, being on the alert for these kinds of behaviors. this is the world that we navigate now. These kinds of relational bullying that have been, that may just be part and parcel of the world forever until people become morally better humans, is definitely blown into something altogether different by the introduction of the internet and social media. It can become very dark and ugly. So, okay, the feminist alert. If you're a feminist, just put your fingers up to your ears right now. I'm not saying I'm completely on board with this, but I don't want to scare the feminists. But there is a Catholic bishop, is described as a traditionalist Catholic bishop by the name of Richard Williamson, that Alan and I listened to a lot. And just about a year and a half ago or something, a listener sent me a biography of his, which I quite enjoyed. He's a bit of a rebel. He was in a dissenting Catholic body. I don't want to talk too much about Williamson other than to say that he had some very unique ideas about girls and women. And some of these brought a lot of criticism, even from parishioners in his very traditional church. You know, the women said, okay, well, that's just too much. And the bottom line was, he said, women don't need to go to university. We don't need women as teachers and doctors and chemists and so forth. Okay, so that's way out there on the anti-feminist spectrum. But he did say something which had the ring of truth to me about young girls. He said, young girls need a different kind of education than young boys. They need to be steeped in the arts. They need to learn ballet. They need to learn how to dance. They need to learn flower arrangement. And what they used to call the Victorian middle class girl was raised with the needle arts and the flower arranging and so forth. You know, we don't get to return to those times. Society has moved on, and you can do what you want in your own home, but I don't see women not going to school to become doctors and lawyers, teachers, right? But I do agree that young girls seem to, not all of them, but many of them, like a bit of drama. And that's what he was saying. Young girls need to be involved in theater productions. The mothers need to create their own theater network so that the girls are learning theater skills and, you know, performance, music. He said all of this funnels the natural inclinations of a young woman, a young girl, in a healthy way instead of an unhealthy way. She's not competing with men. She's not developing the same kinds of behaviors that, let's just face it, might look predatory or animalistic. And I'm not saying that men are animalistic, but I'm saying it's a basic, you know, beating the chest testosterone kind of thing, that parts of that are in nature. And I've never wanted to be one who's advocated for the extreme domestication of a male. In other words, to fit my psyche or make me more comfortable, we are what we are. So I hope I haven't rambled too far over the place. I just think that it's good to remember sometimes that the world in which our children are coming up is filled with a lot of really dark things that weren't there 20 years ago or 40 years ago or 60 years ago. That the kinds of things that our children are exposed to, pornography, now they're getting this in school where their own dealing with the reality of the body that they were born with is undermined by the system. So when you have a system itself that undermines reality in such a grotesque way, and you have a system itself that is advocating for the rights of younger and younger children to have their bodies mutilated in this way. And I could go on and on, but this is in the system. So we can't look to the system for correctives against this type of very cruel, destructive behavior that is involved with the minds of children who there's something not right there. It's one thing to abandon your friend in a dark basement of a swimming pool complex so that you can have a laugh when she's afraid of the dark. But it's quite another to create a completely false digital persona for that person in which they are publicly shamed and mocked, and visuals of them are shared, and their whole privacy and feeling of completeness is undermined, it's destroyed, and their ability to trust, who do they trust? Well, that is going to be it for me today. And next week, I will be talking with Neil Foster. And he and Angry North have they've released their first collaboration. So we'll listen to that song. And I wish you all a good week. Thank you for listening.
I've got something that the world didn't give me, and the world cannot take it away.
All right, guys, I'm live right now, and I want to thank you for joining me this morning. This is the Friday broadcast that I do on my platform here. Before I start reading and before I start talking, this particular broadcast is going to be very impromptu. I'm not reading from a script, as you can tell. And it's also going to touch on topics that are really difficult for me, because there has been a personal, private situations with me in the past that I haven't really talked about publicly. But now is the time to have these discussions, especially since someone in my extended family was affected by something similar to what I went through. Let's talk about predatory behavior, which is what the title of this broadcast is about. So I'll be doing some screen shares. So here's the first thing that I want to read from Dr. Karen Mitchell, PhD. Every action taken by a narcissist, a psychopath, or a coercive controller is done with self-interest, even in relation to their own children. Caring or seemingly kind actions always have a self-focused motive. They are like chess players playing the long game, thinking 50 moves ahead. Even marriage is a cover, so they can lead a double life. there's somebody I follow on Twitter who's a great chess player. I don't think he's a narcopath. I don't think he falls into this predatory behavior. So that doesn't mean that everybody who is a genius at something or an exceptional chess player is falls into this behavioral spectrum. Okay. So I just wanted to put that caveat out there. There is a term that Dr. Karen Mitchell uses in one of her tweets. I want to define it for you so that you can understand what the term means. I'm not finding it. Let me see if I can find it in. Okay, here it is. All right, so let me share this next tweet of hers. Why do narcissists, psychopaths, and coercive controllers or predators love working with or running charities? They are less likely to be suspected of nefarious intent. Governance structures are minimal or non-existent, so it's easier to steal money, purchase goods for personal use, or employ family and friends at high wages who will not report them if they are exposed. And number three, it's good for their image, their constructed facade. And number four, regulatory bodies for charities in most countries have limited resources to hold charities accountable. Regarding predatory behavior, regarding cyberbullying, regarding the topics that we'll be getting into a little bit later, it's that last point that she made here that really struck me, which is sort of what kept me up till 2 a.m, is that nobody's held accountable. I have a personal experience where my cyber stalker and my predator, I never found out who they were. So therefore there was no justice and nobody was held accountable. And that's the dangers of social media, which I have been warning about practically since its invention. So is the fact that people can go in and create personas. They can even create, GoFundMe pages or, Facebook birthday pages, donate to this charity, and then that charity can be funneled right back into them. So that's why I don't think that, social media seems to be a breeding ground for predatory behavior. So the NPCC will often go on boards or become ambassadors for charities that support causes associated with their antisocial behaviors. For example, domestic abusers might connect with domestic violence charities and pedophiles with children's charities. I know of 3 charities that are run by narcissists, psychopaths, and coercive controllers. So that's the NPCC spectrum, narcissists, psychopaths, coercive controllers. And so there is an individual that I know personally that I've mentioned in the past when I've done these broadcasts who falls into this particular category. She was the director of a local nonprofit in the neighborhood of deep poverty that we used to live in for 5 years. And I'll show you what she looks like. And you will be shocked to see that her eyes look like snake eyes, don't they? And it's easy to see, or they look like lizard eyes. It's easy to see why the conspiracy theorists out there think that, Hillary Clinton and various other managerial class types that seem to be dictating bureaucracy to us are, really just lizard people, because this woman did really have all of those qualities. I met her personally on a number of occasions. One of the last times I saw her, I was in the grocery store. She was in the grocery store, and it was a very uncomfortable passing, because I think she knew that I was sort of outing her personality. Everything about her interest in nonprofits is for self-gain. She pretends, of course, to care about the community, when actually the policies and the type of funding that she gets doesn't really doesn't really benefit the community that she claims to be helping. So this is an example of the corporate predator type. She's very corporate. She can walk in between the nonprofit sector, the creative sector, and the corporate sector, and even the political sector. She's like a chameleon, like a lizard. She can walk in between or walk among these types of industries with ease, because like Kamala Harris, I was saying yesterday in our broadcast, she has no internal dialogue. She has no conscience. And this is exactly the kind of person that would be considered a predator. Again, I've met her on a number of occasions. I've seen her respond to authentic ideas that would actually lift up the community. And as JP said, when we approached her for like a community garden, he always likes to say, you could see the wheels turning in her head. Like, how does this benefit me? I don't see how this is benefiting me somehow. So clearly, you know, and so she hops from nonprofit to nonprofit, and she's always in these really high executive roles, CEO, president, or director. And that's why it's so easy for her to jump from, you know, politics to the creative fields to the corporate sector. She can sit down with banksters and, you know, feel really comfortable gleaning money from them or some kind of, you know, donation from them for her facility or whatever. And it really does not do much for the community that she apparently represents. Okay, so this is a classic predator. These are all the people that we've worked with. We deal with them in our town councils, in our local establishments. I mean, they're all over the place. They're the managerial class, right? They're the ones that are applying for the funding for their nonprofits or their NGOs, which are non-governmental organizations. So, Dr. Karen Mitchell talks very eloquently about these types of individuals. Why do narcissists, psychopaths, and coercive controllers or predators love working with or running charities or nonprofits? Number one, they're less likely to be suspected of nefarious intent. Number two, governance structures are minimal or non-existent, so it's easier to steal money, purchase goods for personal use, or employ family and friends at high wages who will not report them when they are exposed. Number three, it's good for their image. They constructed that facade, which, like in the case of Ms. Haynes here, the picture you're seeing of the woman that I've met multiple times, she can go in between these two or three or four different types of industries with ease. Number four, regulatory bodies for charities in most countries have limited resources to hold the charities accountable. So, and again, I want to touch on that lack of accountability as we get deeper into cyberbullying, predatory behavior, and those things that go even deeper than narcopathy, psychopathy or sociopathy. So NPCC, which is narcissists, psychopaths, and coercive controllers, will often go on boards or become ambassadors for charities. Okay. So and they do it for the very, you know, they often do it for the very causes that they themselves, that their personalities are. So for instance, you know, you would often see an individual who is abusing his wife. He's on the board for a nonprofit that focuses on domestic violence. So they always have a cover. Okay. So they always have these masks or these alternate egos that act as cover for them. And this too applies to the cyberstalking and predatory behavior that we see on social media. Okay? People continue to ask about the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath and whether some narcissists have had an abusive upbringing. So here is my response. My PhD data indicates that narcissists, psychopaths, and Machiavellians are all subsets of one overarching dark personality type, which I refer to as persistent predatory personality, or PPP. So let me interrupt that for a minute and take you over to the definition of Machiavellian. I seem to recall that one of my favorite artists out there, she's been around forever, Kate Bush, referred to herself in one of her songs as having some Machiavellian traits and kind of apologizing for that. So let's look and see what Machiavellian is. It is a cunning, scheming, and unscrupulous individual, especially in politics. Let me repeat that. Cunning, scheming, unscrupulous, especially in politics. This is what you get with Kamala Harris, but you also get it with predatory behavior, with children on social media. I personally believe, I used to think that psychopathy or sociopathy were things that were learned behavior, but now I'm realizing that based on, you know, what happened to an extended family member who was a victim of predatory cyberbullying, I think that you can be born with these traits, and I am not equipped to talk about this. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychiatrist. I am just reflecting back what I'm seeing. What I'm seeing on social media, what I'm seeing in the world in general, this cunning, this scheming, and this unscrupulous behavior. So let's go back to the tweet. So her PhD indicates that narcissists, psychopaths, and Machiavellians are all subsets of one overarching dark personality type, which she refers to as persistent predatory personality, or PPP. So this personality type is supremely self-focused, manipulative, sadistic, cruel, and profoundly dishonest, although they often seem upstanding and normal. So MRI imaging work shows that PPP, or subsuming psychopathy, Machiavellianism, and narcissism have prefrontal cortex and amygdala brain anomalies. They are wired to be like this. So this to me, and this is what's sort of been keeping me up late at night, and why I, you know, was up till 2 a.m, is that if you're wired to be this way, if you're born this way, then how do their victims get justice? I feel that we are entering into territory that is brand new. And, you know, I'm certainly not equipped at all, but I'm trying to parse through this based on personal experiences and now an extended experience as, you know, with an extended family. Family member. Okay, some people engage in the same behaviors as persistent predatory personalities. However, their motivation is not the same. The behaviors are a consequence. So their behaviors are a consequence of abuse, childhood trauma. These people are often referred to as sociopaths, and they are different to the PPP, which is the persistent predatory personality, in several key ways. Over time, several terms have been developed to distinguish between the two groups of people exhibiting similar behaviors with a different motivation. Psychopath versus sociopath, malignant narcissist versus vulnerable narcissist, type A psychopath versus type B psychopath, and so on. My data includes there is just one overarching dark personality type, which is deeply malevolently motivated, PPP, and another kind of person who exhibits the same behaviors but do not have the same brain anomalies. The second group of people experience shame and with work may become more effective in their functioning. let's move on to this next tweet here. To see a human predator without their facade and without the mask and without their compelling behaviors that make them seem oh so normal and even lovely and caring and generous, to see through all of that, you'd see that they are cold as ice, reveling in the discomfort and the pain that they cause. This duality takes one's breath away. Before I talk about the extended family member that was a victim of this predatory behavior, I want to tell you a little bit about my experience. This was before I met my husband. I met my husband in 2012. And I don't know what caused the situation. I have gone over my behavior, my relationships, and my friendships with a fine-tooth comb. I don't know why this happened. I'm still at a loss after all these years. It's been well over 12 years since this happened. I'll tell you what happened. An individual, and it could be, I mean, I have an idea who it could be, but it could have been anyone. It could have even been a family member, or it could have been, you know, an old friend or an old boyfriend. I don't know. An individual took my image from my former Facebook account, which I had. I deleted it quite a few years ago and then created a new one. But they took an image from that account and they created a profile on a dating website. And then gave me a fake name. Now, this is what was happening to me in my real life, not even online, not even on social media, because you've heard me say this before I met JP, I had to work, you know, 2-3 jobs at a time to pay the rent in San Francisco and afford to live. So I didn't have a lot of time on social media. I wasn't spending a lot of time on the internet. So the first time that something weird happened was, and there were like 3 or 4 instances total over a span of a few months, maybe a little more than 6 months. But the first time it happened, I was at a small club in San Francisco called Bottom of the Hill. I went to go see a band. A friend of mine is a DJ. I was going to go hang out with him. He was there covering the band, you know, just a, you know, indie pop band and whatever. And out of nowhere, this guy comes up to me and he says, "Diane." And I'm like, "Oh, I think you have the wrong person. I'm Julie," you know. And he just looked at me in complete shock. He was totally shocked. Like he lost his, "I hope he's all right." Well, he just kind of frittered off into the background and I didn't really think anything of it. I continued to talk to my friend and then I was able to talk to some of the people in the band afterwards. It was a very tiny little venue. Okay, so that was the first time. And then I got some weird text messages that were just this gibberishy, threatening, really stalkery kind of behavior that were just insistent. Like it wouldn't, they would erupt for a long period of time and I would be like, "Stop, you're blocked. I don't know what this is about. How did you get my number? Who are you?" And then suddenly they would just stop coming. The text messages would stop coming. So I was like, "Okay, well, it's over. You know, whatever happened, it went away." I also opened up my email one time and I found an image that was horrible. Like, I don't even want to describe it. All I know is that I was shaken. And of course, and so I immediately deleted it and I was like, and I was like, "Shoot, I should have got the email address that it came from." And so all these little things were happening to me and I kept waving them off as mistakes. I kept saying, you know, the world is weird. People randomly find emails and randomly find phone numbers and text and harass people all the time. Just block them, just delete it and move on. Well, I think the last straw for me was when I went to another concert at a venue called the Warfield. And it's a much bigger venue than the first one I went to. The first one I went to is a tiny little club in a like cool neighborhood. It's called Bottom of the Hill. Well, this one is the Warfield, and it's like a big venue with security guards and everything. Well, this guy comes up to me, and totally different guy, and he says, "Diane." And I'm like looking around going, "Oh God, what is going on?" And I said, "No, I'm not Diane." And he got aggressive and combative. And he said, "Yes, you are." And I said, I'm not. What is going on?" And he had his phone with him. And he kept looking at me and looking at the phone and looking at me and looking at the phone. And I was like, "What is this?" And I did something I shouldn't have done, because if you're dealing with a predator or you're dealing with somebody who's being manipulated by a predator, you certainly don't want to get like physical, right? And I'm, you know, not very big. So it wasn't the smartest thing, but I said, "Give me that." And I grabbed his phone and I said, and there was a picture of me with a bio and everything. And I looked at it and I was like, "What is this? Did you create this? What is going on?" He's like, "No, that you and I have been chatting and you told me you were going to be here tonight and you told me to come meet you." And I was like, "What?" Okay, so obviously I had a conversation with the police. I said, "Somebody is using my image to do the cyber stalk thing. They're doing the predator thing." And the police were like, "Was your life in danger?" And I said, "No, I guess not." And they said, "Did they steal any of your property?" And I was like, "No." And they were like, "Well, there's nothing we can do." So this person, to this day, is still out there. They created an online persona of me, pretended to be me, chatted with people on a dating website. And whoever this individual was knew where I worked, knew my social life, knew where I would be, knew my phone number, knew my address. And one time in this whole process, while I was dealing with this cyber bully, they sent me a text message when there was a terrible storm in San Francisco, or a blackout. So all of our lights were blacked out in the apartment, and my roommate was gone. So I was all alone in this apartment. And it was really late at night. And all of a sudden, the text messages started coming in. "I know you're alone. I know that you're afraid of storms. I bet the lights haven't come back on yet, have they? I know exactly like where you live." Like, they were just boom, boom. These text messages were, and then mixed in with the text messages was like gibberishy stuff that didn't make any sense to me, like word salad stuff. And I just, well, you know, I ended up getting a new phone number, because that really scared me. But the police couldn't do anything. Nothing could be done. So that's my story. Now, I felt all alone during this. I felt like nobody would understand. I felt humiliated. I felt scared. I took down my Facebook, you know, account. Of course, since then, I've created a new one since I've been married. I never told anybody about this. But that all happened to me when I was in my late 30s, early 40s. I met JP in 2012, right after I turned 42. Now, imagine a similar situation for a child. And it was all orchestrated by her best friend. And she's 12, 13, 14 years old. It would be so hard to process. So this is where we walk into the conversation about cyberbullying. Now that we understand the behavior, the predatory behavior, like it says right here, to see a human predator without their facade, without the mask, and without their compelling behaviors that make them seem oh so normal and even lovely and caring and generous, they are actually cold as ice, reveling in the discomfort and pain that they cause. This duality takes one's breath away. So right now, I'll show you the obituary for the extended relative of mine who was the victim of cyberbullying and couldn't go on. She couldn't, she couldn't deal with the fact that her friend was behind it. She felt this ultimate betrayal. And being so young, she did find a way to articulate it, which is shocking and surprising. And I'm going to play you some of her music, and I'm going to show you her father and what he did and what he said. So this is my sister-in-law's niece who was a victim of cyberbullying. 14 years old when she took her own life after she discovered who was behind the intense cyberbullying that she was experiencing. One thing about her is she's wildly talented. It's breathtaking, actually. So what happened on my end was I saw a message from my sister-in-law that her niece had died. And I immediately texted her and said, I feel this. I feel it. I'm sorry. And I wasn't sure exactly what she died of. And it wasn't really my place to ask because it's my brother's wife's niece. And so I don't have a real close relationship with the Bradshaws. But I like them. They're all amazing. They're this giant, amazing family, beautiful family. It wasn't until recently that I finally got the answer, and it came through her father's public Facebook post, which I will show you. Please help me spread my Leela's story. I would like to bring awareness and help to anyone who is experiencing or who might have a loved one going through something like it. This is a very special album that I was able to help construct. This album is using a selection of some of Leela's poems and lyrics. This has been the most difficult, but also perhaps the most healing process, allowing me to see, hear, and be close to her in a bond that we shared of music. I attempted to keep her music as close to and pure as I could hear her sing them to me. I wasn't able to collaborate much with her before, but this so hard to read. But this has been occupying a lot of my time in an attempt to honor her established chord progressions, melodies, and styles. Leela was cyberbullied, and she was not able to recover from how bad it hurt her, since it was all orchestrated by who she thought was her best friend. She stayed silent and did the best to move on. She did everything she could, but couldn't shake how it destroyed her reality. That I understand, because as a late 30s, early 40s something woman who was experiencing weird cyberbullying and predator behavior from someone who knew me. My reality was all upside down. I didn't know who to trust. I was in the dark about so much, and it was very difficult for me to trust people. This is her voice. I challenge you to listen to it. Hear what our kids are going through and what they aren't talking about, because they are trying to make us proud or be tough or be like our generation. Her voice is not alone, though. I have also included several tracks of a grieving father, and he's talking about himself. Please let anyone you know, if there is a way I can help them, by taking some of their writings and immortalize it through song, have them PM me. All songs will be on all streaming platforms. I am not a voter. You guys who follow know that if I were a voter, that I had one, I was a one-issue voter, and that was the fentanyl crisis. Now I'm a two-issue voter. If I were a voter, it would also be cyberbullying, because it happened to me, and now it's happened to my sister-in-law's niece, and she's no longer with us because of it. It's important to recognize that when cyberbullying takes place and someone is not equipped to handle the predatory behavior behind it, which is someone with a different shaped brain who is operating in a completely different paradigm than you are as the victim, that the victims who do end up taking their own life or do end up needing some kind of emotional support or help, they're not the ones with the mental illness. This seems to be language that is kind of coming out here and there through, you know, through the edges, seeping in, like the people who are the victims and simply can't stand living like this anymore, that somehow they're the ones that are mentally ill. That's not the case. It's, you know, this individual was not mentally ill. This individual was pure light. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to play a song of hers. There's an entire album, and I'll share the album that her father created. So it's this second one right here. It's called Leela's Ocean. He created an album based on her recordings over the years and based on her experiences dealing with being the victim of a cyberbully. So again, this is her father's name, Tristan Bradshaw. This is an album that he created, and it is called Leela's Ocean, and Leela is his daughter who was the victim of cyberbullying. And she took all of her horror and fear and anger and deep sadness and feelings of deep betrayal and processed all of that through song, through poems, which he then created into an album. Okay? So I'm going to play you this one.
Conversations with myself for hours on end. My friends are asking where I've gone. Hiding in the place that used to scare me the most. Better than walking the hall she roams to. Do I really wanna cry, or do I just wanna go home? Home is anywhere but here, and I hate myself. Nothing feels real anymore. I just wanna go home. Take me home.
I want to share something that her father said. It's been a roller coaster, but about halfway is when you start seeing the significance and severity of what one little girl could do to another. I wrote 4 songs. 3 out of 4 of them were angry. Thank you for helping me keep her voice heard. So it's been a roller coaster, but about halfway is when you start seeing the significance and severity of what one little girl could do to another. I wrote 4 songs. 3 out of 4 of them were angry. Thank you for helping keep her voice heard. The only person of influence that seemed to care about cyberbullying in particular, this person held a public office. This person took that responsibility of being in public office, or at least being near public office, took it very responsibly. And I, again, not political, but I have to give credit where credit is due. And that's her. She's the only person that spoke out about cyberbullying and seemed to take it seriously. This was back in 2018. So I'll play this 1-minute soundbite from her.
In today's global society, social media is an inevitable part of our children's daily lives. It can be used in many positive ways, but can also be destructive and harmful when used incorrectly. I encourage technology and social media companies, schools, and community groups to establish more opportunities for children, such as Microsoft's Council for Digital Good. By listening to children's ideas and concerns, I believe adults will be better able to help them navigate this often difficult topic. Let's face it, most children are more aware of the benefits and pitfalls of social media than some adults. But we still need to do all we can to provide them with information and tools for successful and safe online habits.
So that was in 2018. It doesn't really look like anything has really happened to curtail cyberbullying and this predator-like behavior. This predator spectrum that is a whole different level than psychopathy or sociopathy or sociopathy. Narcissists benefit somehow from their prey, right? Somehow they get something out of it. Predators do it just to do it. And I think that's why when Lila was expressing herself, she was living in the upside down. She was like, I don't understand why this is happening. So let me see if I can pull up another song I want you to hear.
One day, as I was out walking, I saw you and you wanted to get talk. I never realized that evil behind your eyes. You dip and twirl, comes out like your little bird until you let me see your claws unfurl. I saw finally that evil behind your eyes. The sounds we heard made me dip and twirl, comes out like your little bird until you let me see your claws unfurl. I saw finally that evil behind your eyes. I never wanted this, I never needed this. Then you say you're victimless and blame me for your mental mess. What a freak. Hey you, what do you say? Your saccharine words have nowhere to play. They have no meaning to me, at least. Hey you, you vicious beast. How could you do that to me? I never showed, I showed you nothing but love, you see. I didn't mean to be toxic. I didn't mean to lie. We both know you made me anoxic. I'm dying from your lies. So hey, you say I can go on without you today, but I'm still terrified of you. I never wanted this, I never needed this. Then you say you're victimless and blame me for your mental mess. What the fuck? Hey you, what do you say? Your saccharine words have nowhere to play. They have no meaning to me, at least. Hey you, you vicious beast. How could you do that to me? I never gave you anything but my heart. And your words cut me deeper than the sea. I really wanna let this go, but shattered hearts don't really know. I think you made me forget how to be human. Thank you for stealing thousands of lumens. I wish it wasn't you, God, anyone but you. But I guess it's better this way. I hope my ghost haunts you today. Hey you, what do you say? Your saccharine words have nowhere to play. They have no meaning to me, at least. Hey you, you vicious beast. How could you do that to me? I never showed or showed you nothing but love, you see. So why me? Try to honor and go separate ways. So why do you still horrify me? You still horrify me.
You know, I wish that I had had an opportunity to maybe talk to her since I had that really horrifying upside down experience with a cyber predator. Because she does say in the song, why me, why me, why me, why me? Well, it's because, you know, you're a Bradshaw. It's because you're full of light. I feel like I had all these really amazing, astute, profound things to say regarding this situation. And I just don't. There's no law in place to protect this from happening again. There's none of the founders of social media are doing anything about it. They're not going back and reconfiguring social media. There's no vetting system for social media. There's nobody. If you fall under this like diagnostic psychological model, then you can't have a social media account. I know that sounds awful, but we're looking at, you know, a person that doesn't exist anymore as a result of predators being allowed to just, to just do whatever they want, you know. And most of us walk around this planet and operate, you know, in the real world and in the social media world with courtesy and kindness and politeness. Although I've seen it get really ugly, especially when it's adults talking politics and stuff and worldviews and belief systems. You know, this is where you get the clashing going on and the fighting and the infighting, and then it turns to bullying and then it gets ugly and people start blocking each other. Okay, I've seen that. But what this child experienced was demented. And unfortunately, I think it's happening a lot. But the language around predators towards children on social media is always like, oh, we got to watch out for those predators, those, you know, disgusting men that are going after 12-year-olds. I don't actually think, I mean, sure, I'm sure it happens, but I think the real issue with predators is the cyberbullying that this girl experienced from one of her peers. That's why my cover photo is of an innocent little girl on her phone. That's a predator. That's the person who, not that particular image, but that would represent the person that took this child's life. You know what I'm saying? So I think we need to, again, these are conversations that nobody's having, and these are extraordinarily difficult conversations for me because I have to dredge up my own personal life. And I'm thinking to myself for the last, you know, couple of months that this child has been gone from us, when at first I wasn't sure why. And then it was made clear to me a few days ago that she took her own life as a result of cyberbullying, that I'm wishing that I had a closer relationship with this extended family. You know, maybe I would have recognized in her how I too was going through this upside down world, that I was older. She was a child. I was already fully actualized, late 30s, early 40s, right before I met JP, when I was dealing with my cyber predator. And it then transferred into the real world, you know. I was able to handle it because I was a fully formed adult, right? This is a little child. And maybe if I had somehow crossed paths with her when she was going through it, I would have recognized, I would have seen something in her face or in her eyes, and I would have taken her aside and said, I see that you're going through something because I too went through it. Let's talk. I think that her light will continue to shine and her sweet nature will continue to permeate the world through her music.
I always love the smell of cigarette smoke, though I never want to try it myself. But maybe if it came down to the last toke, I think it'd still just prefer the smell of smoke. Maybe I've been too tired to try the paper sticks that friends say will make me high, but I'm already fighting just to breathe. I much prefer looking at the leaves. But just like them, I move around aimlessly with the goals I set in mind, feeling too deep for my toes to touch the floor. I can't feel them anymore. What seemed to drive me to the next week or next day I no longer see. When I see the people passing with their smiles, I remember how they can cover evil and guile or mischief and anger. anger, grief, and denial. Intentions that fester long and deep inside you. If we could just put our feet in glass and to ground you. Maybe it seems like there is no end in sight. To be bound up and wound up so tight. Like there is no hope or light. Is there no end in sight? But there are always leaves and flowers. Supposed to soothe you, but all I smell is mixed with blood with soap to clean my shirt. Mental abuse, the blades to cut loose, pulled into the dirt so I could feel more hurt. You scavenger, you avenger, you're savager, you lavish in hurt. But you make me want to think with soap to help me grasp strings of the hope when I'd have to take a shower to rid you and become a pretty flower to wash and rinse and no longer cower. I won't cower, I'm in power and I'll empower others now. Stupid souls like this that stink of some flowers, making it hard to think, seeming like there is no end in sight. To be bound up and wound up so tight, like there is no hope or light. Is there no end in sight? But there are always leaves and flowers. The color of rosy red, like the natural color on my head, because it's both bright and solemn. Passion district where you can call them delicately color. And if you don't like it, just sounds like a bigger you problem. Oh, leaves and flower, can you please take me home away from the criminal species who can make me feel alone? Bagged up in plastic or clear cellophane, you see beautiful colored leaves and flowers. When I see the city of life of plants removed from their sun showers.